hewed to the ones he knew, without a clock from his own world, but they were at least close.
"It's weird they're the same," Gary said.
"Suspiciously weird," Jason said. "What about the calendar?" Jason asked. "Is that the same too?" The local calendar, as it turned out, was similar, but not the same, although not as close as the time. There were 12 months of 30 days, divided up into early, mid, and late stages of each season. There were 5 additional days that didn't count as days of the month for the solstices, the equinoxes, and the new year, which was at the beginning of spring. "It still seems strange that we keep time the exact same way across two worlds," Jason said.
"Well, maybe someone from your world came here," Gary said, "saw how we do it, and took it back to yours."
"Or someone brought our system here," Jason said.
"Nah, that doesn't sound right," Gary said.
"Are you saying your world's better than mine?" Jason asked.
"We have magic," Gary said.
"We have internet porn," Jason said.
"Will you two please stop?" Rufus asked.
"Gary, go check on Anissa. Tell her she needs to finish up in the next couple of hours."
Rufus, Farah, and Jason went back outside, the others giving Jason and his lingering smell some distance.
"Did something happen to you?" Jason asked the others.
"Like what?" Rufus asked.
"I'm not sure," Jason said. "I'm getting a weird vibe from the two of you. From Gary as well. It feels... I'm not sure how to describe it. Dangerous, maybe?"
Rufus laughed.
"That feeling is our auras," Rufus said. "Now that you're iron rank, you can sense them. We're both bronze rank and not that far off silver, so we're a lot more powerful than you. That's the danger you're sensing. You'll soon learn to differentiate strength and tell a monster from an essence user from a regular person."
"So it's like a warning?" Jason said.
"Yes," Farah said. "But it isn't completely reliable. Some monsters can hide their auras. People can too, if they have an aura power."
They arrived back on the lawn outside, staying upwind of where all the Jason goo still lay in a puddle.
"You've already used an awakening stone, right?" Rufus asked. "Was it much different to using an essence?"
"It was easier," Jason said.
"You need a ritual for those as well, right?"
"You do," Farah said. "Well, not you, apparently, but everyone else. How many stones do you have?"
6, Jason said.
"Good thing you can just use them then," Rufus said. "Going through a half dozen rituals would take hours."
"Wouldn't be that bad," Farah said. "I've done a bunch of them, so I can knock them out fast."
They sat down on the soft grass, and Jason took out his awakening stones, laying them out in a row.
"They were using these as part of the sacrifice ritual?" Jason asked.
"Sometimes awakening stones get used as part of very powerful rituals," Farah explained. "Even essences, sometimes."
"They did make an apocalypse monster," Rufus said.
"Could that thing have really wiped out the world?" Jason said.
"Not to say it wasn't scary, but it didn't seem up to the task of global annihilation."
"They would have had to feed it for a long time before it became a genuine threat," Farah said. "They probably intended to keep it somewhere isolated and supply it with a steady stream of victims. Killing it as soon as it emerged was like smashing an egg before it could hatch into a dangerous animal."
"Even if we hadn't," Rufus said, "there are people far stronger than us that could deal with it. Even if it became truly powerful, there are diamond rank adventurers out there."
"Is that the highest rank?" Jason asked.
"It is," Rufus said, "but you don't see them very often."
"Or at all, if you're most people," Farah said. "I've only met one because of Mr. Fancy Britches here."
"I don't wear britches," Rufus said.
"Rufus's grandfather is diamond rank," Farah said. "He's chancellor of the academy his family operates."
"Diamond rank essence users are the peak of mortal power," Rufus explained. "The Adventure Society likes to keep 2 or 3 in the biggest cities, in case a diamond rank monster shows up. That rarely happens, though, so they largely go unseen. When you're that powerful, the idea of a higher authority is laughable. Mostly, Diamond Rank adventurers are mysterious figures pursuing goals known only to them.
And there aren't that many Diamond Rankers in any case, Farrah said. The only reason they exist in the numbers they do is because they live so long.
They live longer? Jason asked. All essence users age slower, Rufus said. At Iron Rank, you wouldn't notice the difference, but Bronze Rankers can live well past 100. Silvers can double that. Reach Silver Rank young enough, and you look young for decades. Gold Rankers live for centuries, and I'm not even sure Diamond Rankers can die of old age.
They're immortal? Jason asked.
It's a rumor, Rufus said, but a persistent one. There's kind of an unwritten rule that Diamond Rankers don't tell the rest of us the limits of their abilities.
So, am I going to get super old now?
Keep raising your rank and yes, Rufus said.
Wow, that's quite a bombshell, Jason said.
What's a bombshell? Farrah asked.
It's a weapon that causes a great big explosion. Imagine shooting Farrah at people.
We kind of do that already, Rufus said.
So how do I raise my rank? Jason asked. I want some of that sweet immortality action.
How about we walk before we run? Rufus said. You can't even properly progress towards bronze rank until you awaken every essence ability you have. That's all 20. The first step is using those awakening stones.
Jason nodded, picked up the first stone, and took a deep breath.
Here we go.
The stone melted in his hand, sinking into his skin with little fanfare.
You have awakened the blood essence ability, Leech Bite. You have awakened 2 of 5 blood essence abilities.
That's it? Farrah asked.
Jason's stomach made a large rumbling sound.
I was pretty hungry already, he said. I think the stone of the feast made it worse.
You're an essence user now, Rufus said. Eat a spirit coin.
Jason took an iron rank coin from his inventory. It had the metal-grey colour of iron, but was actually made of crystal. Hesitantly, he placed it into his mouth, where it immediately dissolved with an intense fizzing sensation. It tasted like he'd touched his tongue to a battery, tangy and energetic. He felt power flood through his body, washing away the hunger of moments before. Rufus and Farrah laughed as they watched his expressions, wide-eyed and panting.
"What's wrong with him?" Gary asked.
He had left the manor through the terrace doors and approached to sit with them on the lawn.
"He just ate his first spirit coin," Rufus said, causing Gary to chortle. Jason shook his head to clear it.
"I don't think I've ever been this awake," he said.
Rufus picked up another awakening stone and handed it to him. Jason nodded and took it. He went through the remaining awakening stones of the feast in quick succession.
You have awakened the blood essence ability, Feast of Blood. You have awakened 3 of 5 blood essence abilities. You have awakened the sin essence ability, Feast of Absolution. You have awakened 2 of 5 sin essence abilities. You have awakened the sin essence ability, Sin Eater. You have awakened 3 of 5 sin essence abilities.
Jason had abilities before he reached Iron Rank, but now he could feel them within himself much more clearly. They were like hunting dogs, waiting to be unleashed at his command. Even without the descriptions, Jason clearly understood the abilities he had just awoken. 2 came from the blood essence, and were different ways of draining health. The other 2 came from the sin essence, letting him resist afflictions on himself or remove afflictions from others.
My abilities feel incomplete, Jason said, like a puzzle where I don't have all the pieces.
There's a scale, Farrah said. At one end of the scale is people whose abilities are individually strong. Those people don't tend to feel what you're feeling, because their powers might work together but aren't reliant on one another.
Those kinds of abilities are strong, but simple, Rufus said. Farrah's abilities are like that.
Of course, simple doesn't mean bad, Farrah said. Straightforward's power is the usually most effective solution to a problem. It's when you try to get complicated that things go wrong.
According to people with simple powers,
Gary said. Farah stuck her tongue out at Gary.
At the other end of the scale, Rufus continued, our abilities that underwhelm in isolation, but used together, become very dangerous. Affliction specialists tend to fall at that end of the scale, so expect your powers to feel awkward until you get the full set.
Doesn't that dagger of yours poison people?
Gary said. Jason's dagger had been stored away along with the gear of his new companions. He had gotten it back at the same time Rufus reclaimed a pair of ostentatious blue boots. Despite the garish color, he was demonstrably quite fond of them.
You can rely on your dagger for an extra source of afflictions until you've awakened all your powers,
Gary said.
Speaking of which, Rufus said, you have two more awakening stones to get through before we leave.
Jason nodded, picking up the next stone. Unlike the awakening stones of the feast, his next awakening stone was higher rated.
Item, awakening stone of adventure, unranked, rare. An awakening stone filled with the spirit of adventure. Consumable, awakening stone. Requirements, unawakened essence ability. Effect, awakens an essence ability.
With awakening stones, Jason said, you said rarity doesn't make stones better, right?
No, just more specialized, Farah said, and harder to find, obviously. All stones have some amount of focus, but there's no telling exactly what they'll give you. Those feast stones, for example, could have given you anything from mana-draining special attacks to conjuring food to summoning flesh-eating fish. People like to have some control, so stones with desirable specialties tend to be the most expensive.
She patted Rufus on the knee.
Although, when you come from a big, important family like Rufus here, they ship you high-rarity stones by the crate.
There are no guarantees when it comes to awakening powers, though, Rufus said. Not even with the rarest of stones.
What kind of awakening stone is that one?
Rufus asked.
Awakening stone of adventure, Jason said.
Really?
Farah said, surprised.
Those are highly sought after, Rufus said. With a mid-rarity stone, it's hard to pin down what it will give out, but it's almost always a useful utility power.
Just having a bunch of destructive combat powers makes you less useful to a team,
Gary said.
Even Farah knows that. A few good utility powers can really help you when it comes to getting jobs, since lots of teams will be happy to have you along.
Here we go, then, Jason said, as the stone melted into his hand. His whole forearm went numb, and for a moment he could see right through it, before it returned to normal.
That was weird. You have awakened the Dark Essence ability, Path of Shadows. You have awakened 3 of 5 Dark Essence abilities. Ability, Path of Shadows, Dark. Special ability, Dimension, Teleport. Cost, low mana. Cooldown, none. Current rank, Iron, 0%. Effect, Iron. Teleport using shadows as a portal. You must be able to see the destination shadow.
Teleport between shadows, Jason said with a laugh. Now that's a proper magic power.
He looked around for a shadow to try it out on, then stopped.
Aside from this weird springtime estate thing here, Jason said, we're in the middle of the desert, right?
That's right, Rufus said.
I don't recall seeing a lot of shadowy nooks in the barren desert wasteland, Jason said.
It is a lot of open country, Rufus acknowledged. A little disheartened, Jason turned to his final awakening stone.
Item, awakening stone of the apocalypse. Unranked, legendary. An awakening stone containing a seed of annihilation. Consumable, awakening stone. Requirements, unawakened essence ability. Effect, awakens an essence ability. You have 10 unawakened essence abilities. You are able to absorb Awakening Stone of the Apocalypse. Absorb. Yes, no.
I'm a little wary of this one, Jason said.
What kind of stone is it? Farah asked.
It's, an awakening stone, Jason said.
Of what? Farah asked.
Of, well, the apocalypse. Gary erupted into laughter, falling back on the grass. Rufus raised an eyebrow, while Farah's eyes went wide.
Really?
Rufus asked over the top of Gary's laughter. Should I actually use it? Jason asked.
I'm not sure, Rufus said. I've never actually heard of that one before. It does sound like trouble.
You should consider selling it, Farah said. An awakening stone like that would get you enough to buy all the awakening stones you're going to need.
Don't you dare, Gary yelled, sitting back up. You're going to use that stone.
Gary, Rufus said. He needs to be careful with his choices. We don't know what kind of ability that stone could produce.
A powerful one, Gary said. Jason, you need to grab all the power you can.
He's already using a rare essence combination, Rufus said. What if that stone unlocks some power that gets his combination on the restricted list?
You know they're lenient on people who discover new things, Gary said. They can't blame him if even they didn't know.
It's an awakening stone of apocalypse, Rufus said. That's a pretty big hint.
It doesn't matter either way, Farah cut in. Look.
Jason's arm was blood red from where the awakening stone had sunken into it, before returning to a normal color.
That was rash, Rufus said.
Before everything else, adventurers are strong, Jason said. Your words. These abilities I've been getting are fine, but I saw Farah spray lava like it was shooting out of a hose. I want that kind of power.
Yeah, you do, Gary said.
Not helping, Gary, Rufus said.
No, Rufus, Gary said. He's right. He needs all the power he can get, and you know it.
There's no point arguing about what's done, Farah said. Jason, you might as well tell us what power you got.
Chapter 23. I may have made a huge mistake.
Uh-oh, Jason said.
Uh-oh? Farah repeated. What power did you get exactly?
I may have made a huge mistake, Jason said.
Where was that sensibility a minute ago? Rufus asked. What were you thinking?
He was thinking, Gary said, that if you don't want to be a pawn of fate, you need the strength to kick fate square in the beans.
Actually, that's pretty close, Jason said, nodding at Gary, who grinned back.
Would you please just tell us what the power is? Farah asked.
It's a familiar power, Jason said. That's like a magical companion that follows you around, right?
That's right, Rufus said. What kind of familiar do you get from an awakening stone of the apocalypse?
Funny story, Jason said weakly. An hour later, Jason was drawing a complex magical diagram in chalk on the floor of one of the manor's many rooms. They had taken out the furniture and the rugs, leaving a smooth, polished floor. Jason had been working on the diagram for some time, guided by the ritual magic knowledge inserted into his head, as well as Farah's expertise. He stopped drawing for a moment to take some powder from a nearby pouch on the floor. He sprinkled a pinch over the part of the circle he had just drawn, most of which started glowing. He rubbed out the parts that didn't glow and redrew them. The powder was ground down monster cores from lesser monsters. Jason had several, but they were all intact, so the powder had been provided by Farah. She was guiding him through his first magical ritual.
Putting together a magic circle isn't as simple as knowing the right design, Farah explained.
Any time she wasn't pointing out something specific, she was lecturing.
If it were that easy, I could just carry around a bunch of boards with different magic circles on them. Every time you draw a magic diagram, you need to adjust for the ambient magic conditions. A weak source of congealed magic, like the core of a lesser monster, is a perfect way to check your work.
There's a ritual room under the manor with a permanent circle, Jason said.
That must have been expensive, Farah said. You have to design the whole room around something like that to regulate the ambient magic.
Did we loot that room?
Wasn't much in there, Gary said. The most valuable stuff was set behind the walls and into the floor, so Anissa wouldn't let us touch it. It was all pretty trashed anyway.
Jason got to his feet. I'm done. So, am I able to do a magic ritual like this because I already have essence magic?
You really don't know anything about magic, Varys said in wonder.
Was that not clear at any point? Jason asked.
All right, Varys said. You understand essence magic already. Simple, instinctive. Usually doesn't cost anything but your own internal reserves. External magic is the opposite. Complicated. Requires extensive training.
Or a skill book, Jason said.
Or a skill book.
Farah acknowledged through gritted teeth.
If you're satisfied with quick and dirty knowledge...
Don't knock quick and dirty, Gary said. All my favourite things are better quick and dirty. Or slow and dirty.
Farah shot Gary a look as Rufus shook his head.
Ritual magic, Farah continued, relies on external sources of magic. That's ambient magic, plus more concentrated sources, like quintessence or spirit coins.
Scattered all through the magic diagram Jason had drawn were small piles of blood quintessence, looking like uncut rubies. There were also stacks of iron rank spirit coins. There were a few other materials, but the largest requirement by far was the blood quintessence. Fortunately for Jason, and rather unsurprisingly, the manor's magical supply room had more blood quintessence than anything else. The lord of the manor had taken all the bronze rank materials when he fled, but most of the iron rank materials were left behind. It was more than enough for Jason's ritual.
External magic doesn't require you to have an essence, Farah explained. There are people who make careers out of learning a specialized slice of external magic.
Like plumbers, Gary said. They know the magic to set up running water in a building. That shower you like so much.
Exactly, Farah said. They know just enough to do a specific job. Most of those people don't have essences and lack the proper grounding in theory. The fundamental theory is the same, whether you specialize in rituals like me, magical craftsmanship like Gary, or something like alchemy. Same basis, different applications.
What about you? Jason asked Rufus.
I'm good at stabbing.
Rufus doesn't know external magic, Farah said. His obsession is swordsmanship.
Your skill book gave you the minimum to be considered a proper ritual magician, Farah told Jason. The bare minimum. That's how you awakened a familiar summoning power.
You can only awaken that kind of essence ability if you already understand ritual magic, Gary said. That's why me and Farah have summoning powers and Rufus doesn't.
You've seen Gary and myself call up short-lived monsters, Farah said. Rituals that are also essence powers tend to be...
quick and dirty, Gary said with a grin.
Please stop, Farah said.
I remember when you summoned those things, Jason said. You just kind of knocked out a circle and out they came.
Summoning a familiar is a more elaborate ritual, Farah said. Unlike a regular summoning, you should only need it each time you go up a rank, unless your familiar gets killed, in which case you'll have to summon it back.
Not everyone summons their familiar, Rufus said.
That's true, Farah said. Some familiar powers act like a call. And a creature that has an affinity to that call will come and form a bond with the person. Less costly than summoning, but if that kind of familiar dies, you can't just summon it again. You need to find a whole new creature to be your familiar, which may or may not be like the one you lost.
Let's get this thing going, Rufus said. You don't want Anissa to walk in on us.
You definitely don't, Gary said.
Jason stood in front of the diagram. He could feel the power inside him aching to trigger the ritual. He knew the incantation. He had known it since the moment he used the stone. He held one hand over the magic diagram. In the other hand was a knife. He hesitantly cut the palm of his outstretched hand, letting blood drop into the circle as he chanted.
Let this mortal blood beckon the all-devouring power of the final threshold. Answer the call and claim the offering. Heed my command and bring forth the avatar of life's annihilation.
Oh, using that stone was a terrific idea, Rufus said.
Shush, Farah told him.
Red liquid started oozing out of the floor where Jason's blood had fallen. Dark, thick, and viscous, it spread out over the entirety of the magic diagram, obscuring the lines and only stopping when it reached the edges.
Does that remind anyone else of something we saw recently? Gary asked.
Jason felt a prickling sensation spreading throughout his body. It became sharper and sharper, turning into pain as it focused on points on his arms, legs, and chest. He gritted his teeth, but yelled out as blood burst out of a dozen pain points, spraying over the circle. Rufus moved to intervene, but Farah grabbed his arm.
Interfering now would be more dangerous than letting it happen, she said.
Rufus turned a frustrated face to look at her, but stepped back on seeing her resolute expression. Blood sprayed out of Jason like a fountain, ripping right through his clothes. He staggered, struggling to stay upright, as the blood kept spurting out of him. As the blood mixed with the pooled liquid on the floor, the obscured lines of the diagram underneath started to light up, shining red light through the liquid. The other three looked at each other as the room was filled with the same red light that had suffused the ritual chamber they escaped together. Jason stumbled as the blood finally stopped pouring out of his body. He was pale and sweaty, swaying as he struggled to avoid toppling over. But he remained on his feet. His eyes were locked on the glowing red pool in front of him. Rufus and Gary flinched as a leech with a horrifying ring of lamprey teeth emerged from the pool, mirroring the scenario of the day before.
Isn't that ability, sanguine horror, blood, familiar, ritual, summon, cost, extreme mana, extreme stamina, extreme health, cooldown, none, current rank, iron, 0%, effect, iron, summoner, sanguine horror to serve as a familiar.
A second leech crawled up through the red liquid, then a third and fourth, as their rate of appearance accelerated. Soon leeches were tumbling out until they formed a waist-high pile on the floor. Unlike their experience the previous day, no bloodied rags appeared to push the pile into a humanoid shape. The pile remained as a pile. The red pool slowly soaked into the floor, which absorbed it as if it were disappearing down a drain. Jason's blood, the circle he drew, and all the magical materials within it vanished into the floor as if they had never existed. Jason watched the process with eyes foggy, standing unsteadily.
That's not going to drip downstairs, is it?
Gary asked.
No, Farah said. It's all being drawn back through the astral channel created by the summoning.
It'd be funny if Jason summoned another outworlder.
That'd be fantastic, Farah said. The paper I could write on that would be the talk of the Magic Society.
As the final traces of the blood pool drained away into nothingness, Jason collapsed to the floor.
He really does pass out a lot, Gary said. And he really goes through clothes. Wait, is that thing going to eat him?
The mound of leeches was undulating its way towards Jason's unconscious body. It wasn't far, but the pile moved slowly.
It's his familiar, Farah said. It's not going to eat him.
They watched the slow-moving pile undulate closer to Jason's unconscious form.
Are you sure?
Gary asked. The pile crawled over Jason's limp body, seeking out the wounds where the blood had sprayed out. The leeches started disappearing as they buried themselves into the wounds.
I'm pretty sure, Farah said.
Are they crawling inside him?
Gary asked.
It's a summoned familiar, Farah said. A summoned familiar can temporarily disperse its body and place its spirit inside the summoner.
Does it usually look that disturbing?
Gary asked.
You're the one who wanted this, Rufus said.
Farah, what do we do with him?
Well, she said, uncertainly, he should be fine.
He's covered in wounds, Gary said, with leeches crawling into them.
They won't hurt him, Farrah said. They're not even really crawling inside him. Look closely, and you'll see they're actually merging into his blood. See how they're kind of melting as they push their way in?
I think that might be worse, Gary said. I mean, melted leech can't be something you want in your blood, right?
He'll be fine, Farrah said. Probably. Every familiar gives different benefits when it subsumes itself into the summoner. They can merge themselves into the hair, the skin, even the aura. If I remember rightly, the ones who enter the blood usually induce rapid healing. So really, he should be better than fine. They watched as the last of the leeches vanished into Jason's blood. The three adventurers stood over Jason, still lying unconscious and undignified on the floor.
Is he healing?
Gary asked. I can't tell, Rufus said. There's blood all over the wounds.
Well, wipe some off, Gary said.
You're the one who wanted him to use that stone, Rufus said. You wipe some off.
I have fur, Gary said. I don't want to get blood in it.
Since when has that been a concern? Rufus asked.
It's a new thing, Gary said. I'm growing as a person, and I think you should support that, by being the one who wipes the blood off.
Farrah shook her head, pulling a handkerchief out of her pocket. You two are children, she said, wiping carefully at a blood patch on Jason's arm. Underneath was clear, unbroken skin. See? She said to the others. I told you he'd be fine. I had total confidence.
Jason regained consciousness while being rattled around in the back of a wagon. He was on a blanket, but it barely softened the hard wood he was lying on. It was an open wagon, giving him a wide view of the rocky desert as he looked blearily around. In the wagon with him were Farrah and Anissa, while Gary was on a seat at the front holding reins. Rufus wasn't in the wagon, but instead riding alongside. He was in the saddle on one of the two-headed horse lizards called Heidels, leading a string of them all tied together.
"Why would you bring those horrifying things?" Jason called out to him.
"You're hardly in a position to talk," Rufus called back with a laugh. Jason could feel the blood monster flowing through his veins. It was unnerving, but he couldn't help but grin at the sensation of power.
How are you feeling? Farrah asked.
Tired, Jason said, but strong.
Are you still not going to tell me what happened to him?
Anissa asked Farrah, not even looking at Jason.
Him is right here, Jason said, and you could ask him yourself.
Anissa turned her gaze to Jason.
Then what happened to you? She asked.
I said you could ask, Jason said. Didn't say I'd tell you.
Gary burst out laughing from the front, Farrah stifling a chortle behind her hand. Anissa schooled her fury into a look of blank disdain and turned away, staring out at the desert horizon. Chapter 24 Astral Space.
So how long are we going to be trekking through the desert? Jason asked. I'm not saying there isn't a stark beauty to it, but I'd like to go someplace where even the sunshine isn't actively trying to kill me.
They'd left the manor at noon, while Jason was still unconscious after his summoning ritual. By the time they stopped for the evening, he was feeling battered by half a day of riding in the wagon over rocky desert terrain. They camped in tents taken from Farrah's magic chest and set off again in the morning. The wagon's progress along the little-used trail was slow but steady, only pausing occasionally to water the Heidels from a barrel in the wagon. The creatures could handle the arid conditions well enough, but couldn't forego water entirely. There were a dozen of them between Rufus's string and the four pulling the wagon. Rufus had insisted on taking them over Anissa's objection, refusing to leave them to starve in the stables of the abandoned manor.
They had taken a wagon because the lord of the manor had taken the more comfortable carriages when he fled, only leaving a few uncovered wagons behind. After waking up in the back one, Jason had joined Gary on the driver's bench so he could take in the landscape. Luckily, Jason's slight build required little room, as Gary's huge frame occupied most of it.
"It kind of looks like parts of my homeland," Jason said. "We call it the Outback."
"Outback of what?"
Gary asked.
"Outback of everything," Jason said.
"We'll reach a village this afternoon," Gary said. "Not sure how long we'll stay. The guy that set us up lives there."
"We're going to pay him a little visit," Farrah said.
"After that, we're about 2 days from the river valley. From there, it'll be a nice boat ride down to the coast. That'll take a couple of days and bring us right into the city."
"I'd like to take a couple of days with the prick that served us to those cannibals," Farrah said. "We should be leaving that man to my church," Anissa said. "His betrayal to my God was greater than his betrayal to you."
"No one was going to eat your God," Farrah said. "We're going to peel this prick like an apple."
"You have apples in this world?" Jason asked brightly.
"I love apples."
"Me too," Gary said brightly. "Remember not to kill him," Rufus called from where he was riding alongside the wagon. "He has questions to answer."
"Oh, don't worry about that," Farrah said. "I'm going to take it nice and slow."
"Is the heat getting to me?" Jason asked. "Or is that mountain green?"
The hills and mountains they had seen were largely barren, with a few scraggly trees at best. The trail led them in the direction of a dark green mountain. On the lower reaches, it was largely plant life, more verdant than elsewhere in the desert. Towards the peak, it was bare stone, which was also a deep green color.
"Green marble is a regional specialty," Farrah explained. "They export a lot of it through the city on the coast, which is where we're going. They even named the city Greenstone."
"There's a village on the other side of the mountain," Gary said. "That's where we're heading now."
"The village is based around quarrying," Farrah said. "We'll see more traffic from here on as they cart the stone to the river and boat it down to the coast."
The trail improved as it curved around the base of the mountain. It became wider and smoother, making the wagon ride less bumpy. As they made their way around the mountain, Jason spotted rapidly increasing signs of life. The occasional patches of yellow grass became thicker, with more of the rare, scrubby trees. They passed several quarry faces before the village came into sight. The trail had become a proper road at that point, and their wagon became one of many. Jason noticed magic was being combined with manual labor, resulting in a more modern operation than he would have expected. There were even huge slabs of stone floating over the ground, along minecart-style rails that glowed with magic. When the village itself came into view, Jason was agog. From high on the severe slope, water sprayed out from a hole in the mountain itself, catching the light in a gorgeous waterfall that spilled hundreds of meters to a pool below. The pool fed a wide channel, stretching the better part of a kilometer into a small lake. There was a village built up around the shore of the lake. The lake was ringed with green, rich grass and some kind of palm tree. The village buildings were nestled amidst the lush greenery, buildings of stone, white plaster, and occasionally vibrant green marble.
"You could make some real tourist money here," Jason said.
"Pretty, isn't it?" Farrah said. She had got up on her knees behind Jason and Gary to look out. Jason's gaze drifted up to the waterfall, spraying out of the mountain.
"Aren't they worried about digging into the water source?" he asked.
"Almost every oasis in this desert has a magical water source," Gary said. "They could tear this mountain down to the ground, and the water would just fall from the sky."
"How does that work?"
Jason asked. "There's an astral space connected to this desert," Farrah said. "I'm assuming you have no idea what that is." From the name, I'd guess some kind of interdimensional pocket, Jason said.
Yeah, actually, Farrah said. It's connected to various places around the desert and produces a bunch of water, therefore oases.
That sounds awesome, Jason said.
Wonder if I could get up there for a closer look.
Astral spaces are pretty common, Farrah said, but normally they're sealed off, and you need magic to track one down and break in. Being naturally open like this is rare, especially with so many apertures. The river we'll be going down comes out to the biggest one.
You can't just constantly introduce new water, Jason said. Even if it takes a long time, it'll eventually start messing with the climate.
No, Farrah said. The water coming out of the astral space has a high level of magic. When too much accumulates, it turns into water quintessence. When it forms, it condenses huge quantities of magically imbued water into a little crystal.
Is the crystal super heavy? Jason asked.
No, Farrah said. Why would it be?
Conservation of mass, Jason said. Or energy, or something. Physics isn't my thing.
Gary and Farrah glanced at each other and shrugged. They were quickly getting used to not knowing what Jason was talking about. Farrah pointed out what looked like fishing boats on the small lake.
Those are all people scouring the bottom of the lake for it, she explained. As forms of quintessence go, water is a common one. It's one of the most useful, though.
Especially in the desert, Gary added. Being able to find it reliably means there's real money to be made.
Yeah, Farrah agreed. There's whole villages along the coast dedicated to hunting up water quintessence that forms after the river water washes out to sea. Funnily enough, this desert is one of the best sources of water quintessence in the world.
The wagon drew closer to the village. They passed by what looked to be a staging area for exporting the marble before reaching the village itself. Rufus separated himself from the group to find somewhere to stable the string of heidels for the night. An inn would have livery, with room enough for the ones pulling the wagons, but not the extra ones as well. The village was made up of a single, circular street running around the entirety of the lake, paved in tan-colored brick. It looked like sandstone, but for all Jason knew, it could be some weird magic rock. The brick was close enough to yellow that if it didn't loop in a circle, he'd expect to find a shady fake wizard at the end.
Or a real one, he said to himself.
I wonder if I count.
There were buildings on either side of the ring road. The ones fronting the lake were larger and nicer. The smaller buildings were made from the same brick as the road. The larger ones were coated in a white plaster with green marble embellishments. The buildings were pleasantly placed among the trees and bushes growing around the lake. It was a stark contrast to the desert, with its dry dirt and spiky scrub. The smaller buildings had their own appeal, with an inviting homeliness to them. The street was busy with people, but more than broad enough that neither wagons nor pedestrians were inconvenienced. Looking around, everyone seemed happy. Gary pulled the wagon to a halt in front of an inn, and everyone climbed off. After hours of riding the wagon over bumpy ground, Jason's body was creaky and sore. He took in a luxurious breath, heavy with moisture from the lake. Compared to the dust and heat of the open desert, it was like drinking in nectar.
"Think I might walk off the stiffness of bumping along in this wagon," Jason said. "This is my first piece of civilization not full of cannibals. Hopefully."
"They're not cannibals that we know of," Farrah said with a laugh.
"Good," Jason said. "I think I'll have a look around."
"Sounds good," Gary said. "I'm going to get us some rooms and get these heidels unhitched."
"Then Anissa and I will track down our little friend," Farrah said. "Don't want him spotting us and running off."
Anissa nodded her assent.
"Will he still be in town after selling you out?" Jason asked.
"Should be," Farrah said. "He wasn't expecting us to ever come back."
"Do you need any money?"
Gary asked Jason.
"I have some gold spirit coins left," Jason said. "The rest are lower ranked, but I have a lot of them. Will that be enough?"
Gary and Farrah started laughing. Even Anissa had an amused look on her face.
"Jason,"
Gary said. A gold spirit coin would buy the nicest building in this village, and I doubt there's enough currency in it to give you the change. Unless you're buying magic items or bulk trade goods, most people use lesser spirit coins, iron rank at the most.
What's the exchange rate between coins? Jason asked. Actually, I'll figure it out myself. That's part of the fun in coming to a new place, right?
That's the spirit, Gary said.
Chapter 25. Blasphemy is kind of my thing. After handling the string of Heidels, Rufus made his way into the village. He knew from their previous visit that the inns were all clustered together, so he had no concerns about finding the rest of the group. The sky was turning a rich blue, with orange and gold encroaching as twilight came over the desert. Along the ring road of the village, magic lamps were lighting up, and some kind of night market was setting up. He came into the village along with a good many quarry workers who had finished up as they lost the light. Moving amongst the gathering people, he saw a familiar face.
Jason?
Oh, g'day, Rufus,
Jason said with a wave. He was behind a stall selling skewered meat, helping what Rufus assumed was the stall owner to fry meat.
What are you doing? Rufus asked.
Dan here is teaching me to cook... What was it called again?
Bruchard,
Dan said.
It's a giant worm, Jason said. Luckily, I tried it before I found that out.
You seem to be adjusting well, Rufus said.
Yeah, no worries, Jason said. You go get your revenge or whatever. I'm good here. Gary picked the inn on the end with the big livery, by the way. There's a sign with a little house and a cart on it.
Thanks, Rufus said.
Now, Jason said, turning back to Dan. Give me those sauce ingredients again. I haven't heard of any of them, so I'll have to write them all down, which means I'm going to need some paper.
Hours previously, Jason was happily meandering around the Circle Road, frequently pausing to take in the village. He'd stop and talk with villagers, who proved more than ready for a conversation. They were proud of their village, and rightly so. Jason was happy to acknowledge. The colourful houses looked inviting. Everywhere was lush with greenery, so removed from the desert around it. The air was fresh, cool, and clean. Jason thought back to Gary's claim about a gold coin buying whole buildings and found himself tempted. He came across something that looked like a covered bus stop, but instead of a timetable, there was a bulletin board with various pieces of paper pinned to it. Looking over them, he saw that they were all descriptions of monsters, along with when and where the monsters were last seen. He asked a passerby about it, and, true to form for the village, she was happy to explain. According to the villager, Doris, any time someone discovered a monster around the village, they would write down the details and put it up on the board. Every month, some adventurers would pass through and clear out all the monsters on the board. Doris was surprised at Jason's lack of knowledge about something so basic. As he had done a number of times that afternoon, he explained that he had recently come from an isolated area, with little knowledge of the outside world. It was more or less true. Jason himself was as interesting to the locals as they were to him, as visitors were mostly the same selection of stone traders. Adventurers didn't often appear outside of the monthly patrol, and by all accounts were a surly bunch. Roaming the remote villages was apparently a punishment duty, so their visits weren't often friendly. A group of higher-ranked adventurers passing through was the talk of the village. Jason was travelling with them, but wasn't an adventurer himself, making him more approachable. This was the perfect combination for villagers looking for gossip. Jason obliged with harrowing tales of blood cults and ritual sacrifice. The locals showed Jason the best place to get a drink and where to avoid because it was full of drunken quarry workers. He met people who made a career out of diving the lake for water quintessence, the village mayor, and the man in charge of guarding the waterfall. People were allowed to go up for a look, but there were guards at all hours to keep people out of the astral space aperture that was the water's source.
When the sun started to set, Jason watched the sky turn to red gold from the bridge over the channel that flowed from the waterfall into the village lake. He knew from the locals that there would be a night market, and he slowly wandered in that direction. One of the earliest booths to set up was a man frying skewers of meat. The smell of the meat and the sauce he had on them was incredibly enticing.
"That smells amazing," Jason said. "I have to try one. I'm Jason, by the way."
"Dan," the man introduced himself. Gary blearily stumbled downstairs, his huge feet thundering on the wooden steps. Downstairs was a common area, with a number of tables and a bar that saw use in the evenings. Gary wandered into an adjoining courtyard with more tables to sit with Anissa, Rufus, and Farah at theirs.
"Jason not up?" Gary asked.
"I tried his room, but no answer," Rufus said.
"Heavy sleeper," Farah said.
"He was knocked out how many times in 2 days?" Gary said. "He probably needs it."
A serving girl walked up to their table.
"Are you looking for your friend?" she asked. "He's in the kitchen."
"What's he doing in the kitchen?" Farah asked.
"Performing miracles," Jason announced, walking into the courtyard. He was carrying a huge tray with 4 plates. He set it down on the table, distributing the plates and attendant cutlery.
"Turns out they have tamarind and some kind of little onion," Jason said. "So I made son-in-law eggs. No idea why they're called that, by the way, or what kind of animal these eggs are from. Delicious, though." The dish was eggs that had been boiled, then deep-fried, served in halves with a sauce, fried onions, and generous garnish. Jason handed the empty tray off to the serving girl before taking a place at the table.
"I had to play trial and error with some of the other ingredients," he confessed. "But it worked out pretty well. Martha is an absolute treat."
"Martha?" Farah asked.
"These are fantastic,"
Gary mumbled around a forkful of egg.
"Martha's the landlady," Jason said.
"You really seem to have settled in," Rufus said.
Jason nodded, but didn't speak with his mouth full.
"These are good," Farah said, between bites.
"I'm quite satisfied sustaining myself with spirit coins," Anissa said.
"Great,"
Gary said, yanking her plate in front of himself.
"The way I look at things," Jason said to Rufus, gesturing with an impaled egg, "is that coming here is like a fresh start. I can do the things I regretted never doing. I'm only 23, but I've been pretty efficient about squandering my opportunities."
"There's a surprise," Anissa said, flatly.
"Apparently being mean isn't impure," Jason said, prompting Anissa to jump to her feet.
"You dare blaspheme?"
"Frequently," Jason said with a laugh. "It's kind of my thing."
"I think cooking might be your thing,"
Gary said, around another mouthful of eggs.
"I can have more than one thing." Anissa was clearly about to erupt, but Rufus forestalled her.
"Anissa," he said firmly, "if you're not having breakfast, then go get ready to start out."
"I'm already prepared," she said stiffly.
"Then take a walk," Rufus said. Anissa glowered at Jason, but walked away without speaking further. Rufus turned a weary gaze on Jason.
"Is there any chance you could maybe not poke at her so much?" Rufus asked.
"Honestly?" Jason said.
"Probably not."
Gary snorted a laugh.
"Could you at least try?" Rufus asked. "We both know she's never going to bend, so I need you to be the bigger person, for the unity of the team."
Jason sighed. "I guess I have been a bit childish," Jason said.
"All right, I'll do my best. Fair warning, though, my best may not be that good. She just gets under my skin, you know?"
"Oh, we know," Farah said.
"I'm amazed she doesn't bump into things," Jason said, "always looking down her nose like that."
"Think of it this way," Rufus said. "You were just talking about getting a fresh start. Try and see this as an opportunity to be a better person."
Jason thought it over. I like it, he said. I can be the person I choose to be, without all the baggage of my old life.
And if you find your way back to that life? Farah asked.
Then I'll return better than I left, Jason said. That's admirable, Rufus said, then popped his fork into his mouth. These really are good.
Don't talk with your mouth full, Farah told him. You're not Gary.
Was that a compliment or an insult? Gary asked.
So how did your roaring rampage of revenge go? Jason asked. You did say you weren't going to kill him, right? Farah seemed a bit keen on torturing him, though.
We didn't find him, but we have a trail to follow, Rufus said. We'll track him down, ask our questions, then hand him over to Anissa's church.
Assuming we can run him down at all, Farah said. Seems our boy left town in a hurry yesterday morning.
You think the people who ran from the manor warned him? Jason asked.
Most likely, Farah said. We'll do some digging around town today, see what we can find. If we come up dry, we'll move on and leave it to Anissa's church.
Well, you should start with old Murph down at the general store, Jason said. He knows all the village secrets.
Jason, Farah asked, was the world you were summoned from this village?
What? Jason asked. I met him last night.
So, will you be coming with us? Rufus asked Jason. I've had quite enough blood cult shenanigans, thank you very much, and want no part of whatever you do to that man. I found a guy who'll take me to the top of the waterfall. Apparently, there's a mountain path that leads all the way up.
Surely they wouldn't let you go into the astral space, Farah said.
Sadly, no, Jason said. They keep a guard up there to make sure no one mucks about with it. They'll let you get right up close for a look, though. I was going to invite you, but you've got your whole revenge thing going on.
I bet the view is good up there, Gary said. I kind of want to go with you.
Focus, Gary, Rufus said.
If the guy's gone, he's gone, Gary said. If we're handing him over to Anissa's church anyway, just let them deal with it.
No, Rufus said. I have questions that need answering. We're going after him.
Rufus skewered his fork into another halved egg.
After breakfast.
Chapter 26 Waterfall. Jason was only an occasional bushwalker, so as he climbed the steep mountain trail, he appreciated his new iron rank attributes. He hadn't become a sculpture of perfection like Farah and Rufus, but it was still a solid step up. Jason's guide on the waterfall track was a man of late middle years named Hiram. Hiram's job was to watch over the aperture that was the source of the waterfall. Jason had met him the night before, with Hiram agreeing to take Jason along when he started his shift in the morning. Hiram was shorter than Jason, who was not tall either, but with a barrel chest and limbs of thick, ropey muscle. He guessed the shorter man outweighed him by a good margin, and that compact power didn't go to waste. He was hauling a backpack half his own size up the mountain, yet barely seemed to notice the weight. Moisture from the huge waterfall scattered over the mountainside. Farah had told him that the water had a strong power of vitality, allowing the mountain's thick tree cover to grow, even under the desert sun. The dense canopy gave the trail blessed shade, but the heat still made its presence felt. The heat of the desert and the moisture from the waterfall made the air thick and heavy, almost a chore to breathe. To Jason, this small patch of desert felt more like a jungle. There were regular stopping points along the trail, with benches to pause and rest. Hiram didn't seem to need them, but didn't begrudge Jason. Each resting spot was placed close to where the tree line met the waterfall, where the air was cooler, and anyone resting could look out over the village. With every stop on the ascent, each higher than the last, the view became more and more magnificent. Jason had grown up in a little tourist town and knew the kind of money a place like this could make. He suspected his new world didn't see a lot of tourism. The flesh-eating monsters wouldn't help.
"What's that?" Hiram asked.
"Nothing," Jason said. "Best get going again, I guess." The roar of the waterfall grew louder as they closed in on the point where it erupted from the side of the mountain.
The trees became smaller and thinner as they approached the upper tree line.
"Getting close now," Hiram said loudly over the noise of rushing water. "These trees are around the same height as the fall, so only the closest ones see a lot of moisture."
The sound of the waterfall grew to a cacophony where they had to shout to hear each other. The final stretch of the trail was actually a cave that led into the mountain. There was a wooden walkway with grit glued on for purchase and a magic lamp to light the way. Jason was unpleasantly reminded of the cavern he had navigated below the Vane Estate hedge maze. It was the first time he had seen wood used in construction since arriving in the village. The buildings were stone, but even the doors were made of woven reeds, suggesting the village didn't have much of a crime problem. Once they entered the cave, the thundering sound of the waterfall was amplified in echo, making even shouting a futile effort. The cave was filled with wet air, and they moved forwards carefully. Hiram had the respect for the slippery boards that Jason had learned the hard way. When lit up by lamplight on glistening stone walls, the cave was quite pretty, with much of the stone a marbled green. Compared to the humid exterior, cold, clean air blew over them from the tunnel. Jason enjoyed the refreshing feeling as they made their way towards the light he could see at the far end. As they closed on the end of the tunnel, a cool mist wafted towards them. They reached the end of the tunnel and stepped out into a stone chamber. The first thing he noticed was the light, blue and shimmering, glinting off the mist. It gave the whole chamber the feel of being underwater. The chamber looked like it had once been a natural cavern, then later carved into more practical dimensions. The ceiling was untouched from the original cave, but the floor had been worked flat, with grooves cut into it for traction in the wet. The chamber's most arresting feature was the back wall, which wasn't a wall at all. A torrent of water blasted in one side of the room and out the other, through a tunnel taller and deeper than the chamber itself. The whole chamber looked oddly like a subway station, with the rushing water in place of a train. There was a fence of vertical bars in front of the water, like a safety rail going floor to ceiling. There was a gate in the middle of the fence, although Jason could not imagine a reason to go through it. The water looked like it would rip off any limb someone was foolish enough to shove into it. Velocity kept the water on course instead of spilling into the room. Gravity wouldn't win out until the water escaped the mountain. More than a little spray still escaped, filling the chamber with wet mist. It left the walls and floor slick with water, and quickly made Jason and Hiram the same. The water was also the source of the blue light. Either there were powerful magic lamps behind it, or the water had its own luminescence. Jason would have asked Hiram, but any attempt to talk would be futile over the sound of water. Hiram went to the side of the chamber, where Jason noticed a glazed window set into the wall. Through the window was a second chamber, cut deeper into the mountain. Inside, a young man in a comfortable chair was giving them a wave. There was a metal door next to the window, which Hiram opened and led Jason through. Beyond was a small antechamber, barely big enough to hold both men. A lamp was set firmly into the wall next to another metal door, which Hiram didn't open. With a door between them and the main chamber, the din from the water was greatly reduced. Jason noticed that there seemed to be some kind of seal around the door to keep the moisture out.
"Just wait a moment," Hiram said.
Jason looked about the tiny room, but there wasn't much to see. He spotted neat arrays of fingernail-sized holes in the floor and ceiling. As he was looking at them, hot, dry air blasted from them like a giant blow-dryer.
"Close your eyes," Hiram shouted over the rushing air. "The air will dry them out."
Jason did as instructed, waiting around half a minute as the air dried out his clothes and hair.
"It draws the dry desert air from the other side of the mountain," Hiram explained, "with a little bit of magic to help it dry faster."
When the air stopped, they were both nice and dry. Hiram opened the next door and took them inside. There was a comfortable-looking chair in front of the window, a number of cupboards, and an overstuffed bookshelf.
"Morning, boss," the young man said. "Who's your friend?"
"This is Jason," Hiram said, dropping his backpack with a loud thud. "He's passing through with a group of adventurers and wanted to see the aperture. Jason, this is Griff."
"Traveling with adventurers," Griff said enviously. "That must be exciting."
"It has its moments," Jason said. They exchanged greetings and Griff made to leave.
"Any idea when Duggan will be back, boss?" he asked. I'm really looking forward to sleeping during the night again.
His wife is still on the mend, Hiram said. Probably another month.
Griff's shoulders slumped.
Make it to the end of the week and I'll switch with you,
Hiram said. Thanks, boss.
Griff gave a weary smile and left. Jason looked out through the window as Hiram unloaded his backpack, stowing its contents in the cupboards.
Ready for a closer look? Hiram asked when he was done.
Jason grinned and Hiram led them back out. Leaving didn't trigger the drying mechanism again.
It's set to go off when the outer door is opened first, Hiram explained.
Back out in the loud, wet chamber, they walked carefully over wet stone to reach the fence. They both grabbed a hold of the wet bars, which Jason noticed were engraved with magic symbols. As they were close to the torrent, water sprayed over them both, but Jason didn't mind. There was a feeling of refreshment that was more than just cool water on a hot morning. He felt like a child running under a lawn sprinkler on a hot day. Farah had told him there was magic in the water. Was that the cause of his strange reminiscence, or was he just homesick in a strange land? He craned his neck to try and see the actual source of the water, but it came from somewhere deeper in the mountain, where he couldn't see. As there was no way to talk over the noise, Hiram grabbed his shoulder to get his attention. Hiram pointed in the direction the water was flowing, and Jason spotted a tunnel on their side of the fence. The path and tunnel ran alongside the water, through which Jason could see daylight. He nodded at Hiram, and they started off in that direction. The tunnel went all the way to the outside of the mountain, where the water broke free to tumble down through the air. There was a chest-high railing to keep people from falling off. The view was breathtaking. Below them was the pool where the waterfall landed, and the channel flowing into the village lake. Beyond that lay the vast expanse of the desert. Jason was taking in the view when he noticed the noise of the water seemed to be dimming. At first, he thought it was his imagination, but then he saw Hiram looking at the water stream with a confused expression. They watched the avalanche of water rapidly diminish, as if someone was turning off a giant tap. The flow dropped down to nothing, leaving an empty tunnel carved out by the water as smooth as a machine-made pipe.
"Is that meant to happen?"
Jason asked, in the sudden silence.
"No, it isn't," Hiram said, concern plain on his face.
"Has it ever done this before?"
"No, it hasn't."
"Should we tell someone?"
"It's a waterfall, son. I'm pretty sure everyone noticed."
Hiram returned to the interior room, ignoring the warm blast of air to rush inside, still wet. He came back out with a large key, unlocked the gate, and dropped down into the curved floor of the water tunnel. Jason hesitated a moment before following. Hiram glanced at Jason, but didn't comment. Jason immediately spotted the aperture, some 20 meters down the pipe. It was a huge circle with a surface that shimmered with the same blue light the water had produced. Through the circle he could make out what looked like a rainforest, but the distortion of the circle made it blurry and indistinct.
"Is that sky?" Jason asked.
"Is there a whole world through there?"
"Never actually been through to see," Hiram said.
A large shape crawled into view through the aperture. It lumbered through the aperture and into the tunnel, like passing through a sheet of water. It had the body and head of a shark, but instead of skin, it had a plated shell in hues of dark purple and red. Emerging from its sides were 8 crab legs and a huge pair of pincers. The creature was 3 meters long, and the pincers were bigger than Jason's head.
"Do you see a lot of those?" Jason asked.
"No," Hiram said. "That's new."
New quest, waterfall monster. A monster has unexpectedly emerged from the local astral space. It has already entered the blind aggression stage and will attack anyone it encounters. Defeat it before it causes any harm. Objective, defeat the Shab, 0 of 1. Reward, quintessence.
"I don't suppose you know what that thing is?" Hiram asked, drawing the knife on his belt.
"I think it's called a shab."
Jason drew the snake-tooth dagger at his own waist.
"You any good with that?" Hiram asked.
"No,"
Jason said.
"No, I'm not."
Chapter 27 Water Fall.
It's pretty slow, Jason said. If we get back behind the fence, is it strong enough to hold it?
Not sure, Hiram said. It's mostly to keep out people. The magic is just to stop the water from ruining it, not make it any stronger.
I guess we fight then, Jason said, reluctantly.
I guess so, Hiram said, equally lacking in enthusiasm. The creature was moving up the tunnel, but at a lethargic pace. Its crab legs were better suited to sideways movement than forwards, so it was shuffling side to side as it approached. The back-and-forth motion was hampered by the curved sides of the pipe-like tunnel.
"Do you have any essences?" Jason asked. "Is that what I've been feeling in your aura there?"
"One," Hiram said. "You're an adventurer. I thought the people with you were the adventurers."
"They are," Jason said. "I have the essences, but they're very new."
"You can try them out here, then," Hiram said. "I guess you're in luck."
Jason chuckled. "That's exactly what I was thinking. How lucky I am to be here." The creature continued moving closer, its legs tapping on the stone as it slowly zigzagged up the tunnel. "Any idea on how we should do it?" Jason asked.
"I have a mite essence," Hiram said. "It makes me strong. If I tie up those pincers, think you can get around them and kill it?"
Jason looked at the creature. His knife wouldn't do much to the hard shell, but it was just right for digging into the segmented joints. "Yeah, I think I can do that." Hiram looked at the knife in his hand and shoved it back into its sheath before striding down the tunnel. Jason followed behind, his own knife at the ready. As they drew closer, one of the pincers shot out and Hiram caught it in one hand. The stocky man and the creature struggled back and forth, but Hiram didn't employ his second hand yet. He waited for the second pincer and grabbed that one too. Hiram stood with hands over his head, a pincer gripped in each one. His arms swayed like branches in a storm, but his body was the tree's unmoving trunk. Seeing Hiram and the monster in a standoff, Jason knew it was time to act. The sides of the round tunnel curved up, wet and smooth. Closest to flat was the middle of the tunnel, which was unfortunately full of monster. Jason had two options for getting behind it. One was trying to slip